My guest this week is the biographer Susie Harries, who has specialised in 20th century artists, among them the composer Elizabeth Lutyens. Her most recent subject is Nicholas Pevsner, the architectural historian who was born in Germany in 1902. He came to Britain in 1933, where he established himself as an authority on English art and architecture. Pevsner died in 1983. Susie Harries, you're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Pevsner's wife Lola came from Germany with him. That marriage seems to have been the bedrock of his life. I mean, I know he had crushes or infatuations nonetheless, but the marriage was key, wasn't it?
It was key, and I think it was one of those relationships that was greatly helped by them being able to share a work interest. Because although she, I think, felt rather out of place in England, she never really settled as he did. She had a job. Once they were launched on the buildings of England, he couldn't have done what he did in those first years without her. She was his driver, mm-hmm. And she was his sort of prop and mainstay once they were on the road. It was she who would sit late at night while he was writing up what he'd seen. She'd got the maps out, she was planning the next day's itinerary. She was the one that made it possible to do anything as many as 18 churches in a day. Hmm. So they had that in common, and it made her feel part of the life that he was building in England.
You get the impression that he didn't act on the crushes, was that so?
You can tell from his diaries. He's constantly berating himself for having the crushes, which he thought were undignified, but then for not doing anything about them. He felt he was neither a sort of a saint or a proper sinner.
Well, in the light of that, she might never have known about them. I mean, if he hadn't
made it so obvious. It was something. He was very hard on himself in his diaries about it. She'd have noticed because, you know, it's
women know these things.
But no, I mean, the one person he could talk to about them was her, which is bad luck, really. I mean, she was probably the last person who wanted to hear about it.
You mentioned the diaries. How much of the diaries were destroyed?
The years covering the marriage, because she asked specifically, she said, this is a record of my life as much as it is of yours, which is true, because they were personal diaries. So that was the years from 23 to 63, which is when Lola died.
A long spell, isn't it?
It's a very long spell. Yeah. I mean, I think the most active period of diary keeping was, in fact, the first years when he would make 3 or 4 entries a day. Mm. And certainly they petered out as he got older and had less time.
He arrives in England for a second time in 1933. And we move on to something that is really quite central to the book, and that is that he discovers quite a contrast between the kind of art history he grew up with in Germany, weighted towards rigorous scholarship, and the English variety, which veered much more towards connoisseurship and good taste.
Yes, and people seem to be more interested in the provenance of individual objects than they were in the grand theory. There was very little theoretical art history. Mm. I think he... What he was looking for was something that could combine the merits of both approaches.
And there was also the class element, of course, you know. A class element to the English approach, wasn't there?
In practice, I'm sure it wasn't deliberate. But yes, I mean, what he saw when he arrived was a class of highly educated, highly cultivated connoisseurs who kept their knowledge more or less to themselves, as it were. I mean, like museum curators who just as soon not show their objects to the public.
No, but also classmate in the sense that the people in England who attended such matters were more interested in the owners than in the objects.
There was an element of snobbery. I don't think he would have accused everybody of it, but
it was there.
It was certainly. I think
you have a lovely name. I dined with the Earl's School of Architectural History, which captures it.
Yes, when he visited a house, he'd probably be more interested in their staircase and the fireplace than in the history of the house, in terms of the people who'd lived in it. Yeah. And I think that some people find that disappointing. They want to know more about the family. And for that, he said, well, you need to take another guidebook as well.
But the point is, he was used to a much more rigorous tradition of scholarship than what he found here in England.
A more analytical approach, certainly. Mm. I mean, he was interested in the analysis of the forms of architecture. And he didn't find
it. So it was more the absence of theory than the fact that they didn't apply themselves fully to it.
I think so.
Yeah. In the pioneers of the pioneers of the modern movement, he traced the line of it from William Morris to Walter Gropius. And this is where, you know, Pevensey's heart lay. You make the point that he was no historical determinist, but he believed it was possible, you know, to trace other lines from what he called the rogue Victorians to Art Nouveau to Godey. In other words, that he softened towards the decorative line as time went on. He moved away from the more hard-headed approach that he had adopted.
Yes, he did. I think Pioneers was always just one way of finding a path through the extremely complicated pattern of art historical developments. He never said that there weren't other ways of doing it, but he, I think, was keener when he started because there was so little serious study of modernism in England. He was very keen to push that one particular line. Later on, as more people became interested in modernism, he didn't have to push that line so hard. So he was more receptive to the suggestions that he'd missed things that were important. And in fact, he initiated other scholars' studies of the other paths, as you say, the sort of expressionist path through art history.
It wasn't that he was denying it. He just opted for the other one. And he said, I'm not denying the others are legitimate in their own way.
No, I think it was just partly a temperamental preference. He preferred the modernist line. He described himself as a square man. I like things square. Mm-hmm. He liked the purity that he saw in modernism. He didn't particularly like the exuberance and the individualism that he saw in expressionism. Although when he saw a really cracking example, he was bowled over by the Gaudi Cathedral in
Barcelona. Yes,
he didn't like it, but he. Mm. You can't deny it. It's a phenomenon.
Yeah. In other words, he wasn't exclusionary in that way in his approach.
No, I think he's often made out to be far more dogmatic and prescriptive than he intended to
be. Yes, yeah.
He was clear about what he liked. He didn't rule out the possibilities other people would like other things.
Well, I mean, you know, it's hard otherwise to understand his involvement in Victorian restoration. I mean, if there wasn't that other side to him.
I think he liked the Victorians as long as they shared the quality he admired so much in modernism, this quality of being serious, of being earnest. I think if you get a Victorian architect who is trying to convey the spirit of his time, then Pevensey would admire it just as much in a Victorian church as he would in a modern factory.
Yes, that spirit of the Asian Ocean, which we'll come back to, that was quite central to his thinking, wasn't it?
Very much so. Mm. Yes, that was that was the German heritage.
Yes, yeah.
The idea, the Hegelian notion that there was a spirit of the age which would pop up everywhere.
Even though Gombrich resisted that.
Yes, Gombrich always argued with him about
it. Yeah. That people, the other group of Germans who were at the Warburg. Mm. Including Gombrich, you get the impression he wasn't that close to them, was he?
No, he wasn't. Mm. There wasn't any kind of war. It was more, well, Gombrich himself explained this to me. I mean, he said this was more that Pevensey had moved into the popularising of art history, and also that he didn't share the primary interests of the Warburg, which were obviously the Renaissance and sure. iconography and this kind of thing, not Pevensey's particular interests. But if there was a divide, it was more to do, I think, with the fact that he was, in their terms, not a scholar. Yeah. I mean, he felt very much the same. When he spoke to Gombrich, he said, you know, you are a consultant, I am a GP. He saw his role as being a bit different, really.
It's very interesting that way. Very hard to place Pevensey in that he was neither a grand theoretician on the one hand, nor that kind of close scholar on the other. So what was he really?
Well, I think he described himself as a compiler. I mean, he regretted it because he started life, obviously, as a fast-track academic, a specialist in mannerist painting. And he had to adapt in order to survive when he got to England.
Yeah.
And he transmuted himself into, well, he disparaged it as being an editor and a compiler. But I think he was a communicator, really, is what makes him so potent.
He wanted to share his knowledge. I picked that up a lot from you. That was very, very important to him.
I think, yes, but I mean, partly on principle, he felt everybody deserved to have knowledge made available. That's a German thing. That's a product of a German education, the broad cultural background. But I think also it had been the main source of pleasure and relief in his life. And I think he was an evangelist for it. He just felt people's lives would be richer if they understood more about art history, and particularly about the architectural history they could see around them all the time.
Yes,
you can't really dodge architecture. You can avoid going into an art gallery. But you see buildings all the time. And if you know what you're looking at and appreciate the developments that are right there in sort of stone and glass, your life is better.
And yet you say that part of him regretted reneging on his German past, if you like, that he didn't follow through and become a German scholar of art history in the traditional sense.
Yes, well, I suppose if you've been brought up with one set of criteria for success, which is rigorous scholarship, original research, writing articles, getting published, even if you achieve other kinds of success, you're always going to slightly feel that they may fall short of what you meant to be in the first place.
And do you believe he hankered after that all his life, that past, of not having followed through, or how strong was it feeling?
Certainly in the latest of the diaries, you get this very regretful sense that the sense of failure, just when he's at his most publicly successful. It's very interesting to find him writing in the diaries, you know, my work has gone thin. And he looks at his contemporaries and they've achieved what he considers to be academic successes that he hasn't had. But I think it's true. I think by the end he did appreciate
what he had done,
what other people got from what he had done.
Yeah. His job at the Architectural Review, which was quite important, and what I picked up from that was the way in which he was drawn towards the English picturesque tradition, the influence you mentioned, I think, of de Crone and Hastings.
Yes.
So, in a way, this again was further evidence that he wasn't just hung up on the pure modernist line.
He wasn't hung up on it, but I think he enjoyed being able to find ancestors for it. I think it possibly coloured the way he looked at modernism after that, because he saw in the picturesque softer qualities, the breaking up of a housing estate with landscaping. I think what he saw was a humanising trend that is very obvious if you look at a landscaped garden.
And which was absent from the great modernist works. I mean, that sense of room for the person,
I
the individual,
so.
Yeah.
I mean, he and Le Corbusier were never eye to eye, and I think that this idea of the building as a machine for habitation,
yes, yeah,
as it were, was
yeah.
one that was alien to Pevsner.
Just remind me about that, because if I remember, he admired the work but didn't like the man. What
he
was
that?
He admired
the early work.
Mm.
I think he felt there was a strain of ego, probably, that was manifested in much more expressionist kind of work. I think he regretted the move, what he saw as a move away from the original clean lines and purity and simplicity.
And yet it has its own glory. I mean, places like Longchamp and so on.
It's interesting. I think he may have criticised Longchamp on paper before he saw it, and he certainly expressed far more sympathy for it in later years, which may just be simply that he went there, he saw it, he didn't mean to be bowled over, but he was.
Why did pioneers of the modern movement become, in your view, his most contentious work?
I think partly because it was so successful. He wrote it as a, I suppose, as an act of rebellion in some ways against the fact that there was so much neglect of modernism in England. But it was taken, it became a textbook, and I think it got sort of fossilised and simplified, and the way in which it was taught as kind of the orthodoxy, I suspect may have rather horrified him if he'd realised what was going on. I mean, he did later in his life say he wished it would go out of print. So I don't think he ever meant it to be, as it were, set in stone.
So people could use it, of course, to their own ends.
Well, it made a wonderful textbook because it offered these simple lines and this wonderful pattern.
Yeah.
It was very influential. And I think once something becomes the orthodoxy, then other people are going to want to overturn the orthodoxy.
We must talk about the work by which he's best known, The Buildings of England. You remind us the contract was 1946, and between 1951 and 1974, there were 46 guidebooks. That's an enormous amount of work, isn't it?
That's the thing I admire almost the most, is just the not being daunted by the scale of the thing and not taking any collaborators for the first 15 years or so, until he began to be afraid that he wouldn't survive to finish it. No, it's an astonishing volume, just simply, if you see the photograph of him with the finished product, it's just a huge weight for anyone to carry, I think.
And he didn't try to evoke atmosphere, bringing him into sharp contrast, if not conflict, with, and I suppose you could say that to some degree, with people like John Betjeman, who were doing precisely that.
Yes, I think he didn't feel it was what he was particularly good at.
Mm-hmm.
But also, there just simply wasn't room once you start. I mean, I think it's unfair to say he never tries to. I mean, sometimes he does it. If you go to something like St. Mary's in Whitby, it's an extremely evocative description of a building, or Durham Cathedral, even though there's an enormous amount of technical detail.
Yes.
You still get a very strong impression of the place. But I suppose it's when you look at the description of your local church and find it just says something like either not very nice,
yeah,
or the usual West Tower, that it's disappointing. And you wish he had said, you know,
a little bit more
about the background feeling and the atmosphere.
Is it true that Betjeman hated Pevsner, but Pevsner in turn bore no grudges? Does that capture it?
He wasn't a great one for feuds.
Mm.
It's very hard to, I'd be surprised if there was no hard feelings at all, but they certainly were able to work together perfectly comfortably, and they had very friendly correspondence. Face-to-face, they were fine. Betjeman did niggle behind his back. And Pevsner was, I think, probably too dismissive of Betjeman's admiration for people like Ninian Comper. That's where I think the root of the disagreement actually lay, from Pevsner's point of view. Betjeman had a much more high church approach.
Yes.
Than he did. Pevsner liked
just his. On that point, by the way, Pevsner converted from Judaism to what, Lutheranism, was it?
Yes. Indeed.
So just on that, did his wife convert as well? What was the?
Yes, she was brought up Lutheran.
Mm.
He was educated. He took lessons in Hebrew, but Pevsner's family was not particularly observant.
She was more a cultural Jew, if you like, and than a rigorous practicing one.
Yes, certainly not a rigorous practicing one.
Yes, yes. No. There's that quote from Betjeman to James Lee Milne: "The new refugee scholars who have killed all we like." You know, that's quite revealing.
It is revealing. I think John Summerson said, I think he explained it quite well. I mean, he said he felt Pevsner turned a floodlight on romantic twilight areas, and by dissecting what he saw, took the life out of it. I mean, I think that probably is what Betjeman meant. But I think also Betjeman was talking about the conflict between a very comfortable and chatty amateurism and a much more businesslike professionalism.
Are we in danger of engaging a stereotype here? I mean, this is a kind of standard line about British intellectual, or indeed English intellectual life, that it's amateur and so on. But, I mean, as you said, there were a lot of pros around, hard-working pros.
There certainly were, yes. But I think Betjeman wasn't one of them.
Yes.
I think that was... it's not that he didn't achieve a lot, and it's not that he didn't contribute hugely to the understanding of architecture.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
he did it in a completely different way. And it was outside academia, it was outside scholarship. He concealed his scholarship, I think.
He had two outstanding graduate students that made quite a name for themselves, Rainer Banham and David Watkin. First, Rainer Banham, what was the relationship there? I mean, he came to our knowledge first as a champion of technology, and presumably wouldn't have been at one with Pevsner on that.
Not on that, no. I mean, I think that Banham came to Pevsner as an admirer. I think he particularly mentions the outline of European architecture as a kind of ray of light during the war years. He was a huge admirer of him as a communicator. But I think the more they discussed modernism, the more Banham and presumably Pevsner came to realise that they were heading in different directions. On the whole, Pevsner was perfectly happy for his pupils to do that. If he didn't ever try and stop his pupils from developing their own lines of thought.
Yeah, Banham standing for what, essentially?
Well, Banham, I think, standing for a broader take on modernism that gave a far more prominent role
to technology.
Yes, to the actual mechanics of modernism.
Yes. And that was quite new at the time, wasn't it? I mean, that attention to the entrails themselves, entrails of a building. Yeah.
I think it was. I mean, I think this is Banham as brutalist.
Yes,
and this is Banham in at the beginnings of brutalism. But it's something that people have said to me, that Pevsner wasn't particularly interested in the workings, in the mechanics,
in the
actual processes of building.
David Watkin then was much more ungrateful. In 1977, he wrote a book called Morality and Architecture, in which he was arguing that Pevsner had seen architecture in purely instrumental terms, as a means to furthering values or religion or whatever.
I think he specifically complained about the importing of morality into architecture. I think that there were a lot of different threads to his reaction against a very influential teacher. I think one of them is possibly the background of Peterhouse, which tended to see the politicising or the moralising of any abstract discipline as a bad idea, particularly if it was heading in the direction...
leftwards of anything.
Well,
yeah,
exactly, yes.
Yes,
and I think there was... it was a very complex relationship.
Just to be clear about that, Watkin had the support of the Peterhouse Brigade of the time of Maurice Carling, Ian Norman, Roger Scruton, and they would have taken him to their bosom. Why? Because...
Well, I'm just assuming that they, because they were part of a particular Peterhouse generation around Maurice Cowling, that they were very much opposed to this Whiggish idea of determinism, of progress towards a particular kind of modernity, towards collectivism. That Pevsner, to Watkin, epitomised this Hegelian philosophy of progress towards modernism as a good thing, when certainly David Watkin obviously is on record as deploring many of the consequences of that.
You also make the point
progress.
That he must not quite misquoted him, but quoted only part of his work, of Pevsner's work, that is. Yeah.
Yes, I mean, that's... It's not uncommon in
no, but I mean, what comes through
study.
What comes through here is, if I may say so, is that you're quite... You really like Pevsner.
Yes, I did. I think he struggled to be fair on his own terms. And I just think it's important to defend him against criticism that is essentially unfair.
It's an extraordinary story, isn't it? Here he comes from Germany, makes this remarkable career and goes right to the top in architectural history and so on in another land.
Yes, in another language. I mean,
another culture and so on. Yes.
He was forced in a way to take directions he never meant to take, and he adopted a task in the buildings of England, which was going to condemn him to making mistakes all the time.
Yes,
he took on this massive task.
Yeah.
Which he couldn't possibly deliver to the standards he'd been brought up to expect. And he didn't give up. He didn't... He because he believed in the worth of what he was doing, he finished it at considerable cost to himself.
Am I right in thinking, though, that in the Reith lectures on the Englishness of English art, that I think you say he didn't really understand Englishness, though, did he?
There's a lovely quote that a 19th-century historian applied to Disraeli, which said he loved England, but not quite in the English way. And I think he did. He did love England. I wouldn't say he was an Anglophile particularly.
No. Didn't say. I said that understand Englishness was what I understood you to be saying, that he really didn't.
I think that the trouble with trying to define Englishness is that you set yourself up immediately to attack. I think he understood it probably as much as any of us do.
Made a good stab at it, yeah.
But, if you're asked to then, deliver six lectures, but also provide a philosophy of Englishness. No, I think that there's a lot in it, including this underlying train of thought, which we shy away from, which is to think that there are national characteristics in art, which sounds uncomfortably sort of racial theory.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Does self-deprecation fit in there? His perception of English was as including that.
I don't think he ever believed in the sincerity of it. I think he distrusted overt self-deprecation, yeah. I think. There were other qualities he admired enormously.
Inconsistency, I think, was that one?
Yes.
Yeah.
But I think more positively, things like tolerance and pragmatism.
Forgive me. Tolerance, yes.
Tolerance. Yes. There were a lot of things he liked. He was very fond of the story of a Bengal lancer.
Lancer, yeah.
Which he felt exemplified the British gentleman at his best. I mean, he wrote this in 1935. It's a very peculiar time for a German refugee to be admiring the qualities of the English gentleman. But he did. Yeah. There was a kind of principledness and honesty that he did admire wherever he saw it.
Susie Harries, thank you very much indeed.